Today, the first-time buyer's dilemma. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Quick reminder that on Tuesday at 8pm Sydney time, we'll be running our next live stream, and there we'll be discussing first-time buyers, and specifically whether they should buy or whether they should wait. And I'll be joined by Veronica Morgan, who runs the First Time Buyer Academy, as well as a co-presenter on The Elephant in the Room. Of course, she also presented Location and is a property buyer. And she'll be joined by her colleague, also involved in advising first-time buyers. So we're going to get some very explicit advice on Tuesday, and you can ask a question live. The links are below if you want to send in your question beforehand, or come in on the night and ask the question in the live chat. I look forward to seeing you then. Today, I'm joined by Steve from Canstar. Hi, Steve.
G'day, Martin.
Great to have you back on the show. Thanks for spending some time. I know you've had a busy day. We're doing a series on first-time buyers over the next few days. And I wanted to pick your brains on this because I am getting lots and lots of questions from first-time buyers. There are a whole bunch of initiatives, from the government incentives to state incentives to all sorts of things. And it's quite difficult for people to navigate through. And I wanted to get your perspective, you know, not least because a number of first-time buyers are thinking, well, maybe I should take advantage of some of these offers. But as with all of those things, there's often a bit of a cloud to the silver lining or vice versa.
Yeah, there is. I mean, this is very generous stuff happening. I mean, state governments are not charging stamp duty or big concessions on stamp duty. Some are waiving it altogether. State governments are putting in, you know, sort of $15,000 grants for new homes, and the federal government has a $25,000 grant. That's $40,000 between them, no stamp duty. And then, of course, you've got the first-time buyer deposit scheme, 5%. You don't have to pay LMI. And a lot of lenders are absorbing the LMI costs themselves. Big incentive. You know, if you get $40,000 up front, well, that's a fair bit of your deposit anyway. But yeah, I mean, it's not the only story in town, is it? There's more to it than just that. And so people have to sort of say, well, I'd love to take advantage of this, but is the time right for me anyway?
Right. And I think that's the point. You know, that there are broader timing questions, firstly. So, for example, we are in an environment where employment is probably more uncertain than it's been for certainly the perhaps a generation, frankly. You know, unemployment rate is what looked to be 8.5% by the end of the year by the RBA and maybe 6.5% in 2 years' time. But then the mix of employment's changed, so more people are on part-time work than previously. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if there's a risk around employment, then committing to a mortgage at this stage is certainly fraught potentially with risks. The second point is that even if you do actually pursue a property and you know, go for these 95% loans, there's no guarantee that the rate that you're going to pay is as good compared with those that actually maybe have a bigger deposit, right? So there are some financial consequences of that too. So, I mean, what's the right way to think about this in terms of trying to navigate the complexity?
Yeah, look, it's so tricky. I've always been of a view that says, look, you've got to say, look, first up, is it the right time for me? And if it is, can taking advantage of the incentives bring me a year closer? And that's the way I think people should look at it. Not to say, look, I was planning to raise 20% deposit. That meant saving $100,000 over 4 years. But now I've changed my mind suddenly because I can pick up $40,000 worth of grants and now I'm going to jump straight in on 5%. I don't think that's smart thinking. And the other problem is that to get full advantage of these grants, you really have to be building. And first-time buyers building, you know, it's tough enough to learn the ropes just buying a place that you can see, let alone buying a place off a plan and contracting with a builder. There are lots of traps there that first home buyers probably aren't ready for. But yeah, I think I'm more skeptical about being too influenced by grants. I think it's sort of the thing that brings you forward by a year, but not the thing that brings you forward by 3 years in a 4-year plan.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, those first grants, and let's focus on the homeland package ones first, right? Because in WA, if you add the state and federal incentives, it's $55,000, right?
Yeah.
But the first observation there, when it was announced, guess how much land and home packages went up by? $55,000. It's line ball. So in other words, now suddenly you're paying more than you were, first point. The second point is, yeah, with the homeland package, of course, you are committing to a construction cycle when construction costs are perhaps variable. Some particular types of materials, for example, you know, some types of bricks and things are now less available and more expensive, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the question also is, what's going to happen to the market between now and when you actually complete? Because you might be locked into a particular price now, but you've got no guarantee that prices will be higher, you know, in 6 to 12 months' time, whenever it's actually locked in. So that means that essentially what you're doing is potentially guaranteeing nothing and banking on something. Well, you're not sure, because prices might go up, might go down. So that's the other point. And then the other factor, of course, is that what tends to happen is it tends to lift prices of new property, but at expense of existing property. So if I were thinking of buying in the similar area, I probably would think of looking for existing established properties who may actually have dropped, and I'm seeing that in the data, simply because there's a significant spike towards homeland packages.
Yeah, I got excited by that when these measures first came out, because I said, well, look, this is distorting the market big time. And let's say you bought a new place. Let's say you've just moved into a new place. You can expect the price on that place to fall dramatically because of this. Now, that's, you know, if you're buying in a new place in an outer suburb where there's a whole lot of building going on. Now, if you've bought bought in an inner suburb, I think you're a little bit more immune to that. There's a bit of subdivision going on, certainly, but in an inner suburb, you're a little bit more immune to it, because people want to buy those suburbs for a different reason. Lots of lifestyle stuff and prestige stuff and all that. But certainly in the outer suburbs, it will really distort the old from the new and hold down the 3-year-old property, because people will say, well, gee, I can pick up $55,000 worth of help by building brand new. So it'll be problematic. The other thing about what you're saying about prices is that it goes whether you're buying new or existing. The worry I have is that people have spent 4 years saving $100,000 to buy a $500,000 home unit, jump in and buy, and 6 months later, property prices could still have gone down 10%. A lot of people were saying 10-15% when COVID started. We haven't seen it yet. But as you pointed out at different times, the lag is about 2 years. Yeah. So the worst in the property market could still be ahead. It would be devastating to have saved you 20% and then see half of that carved off, and now I've got $50,000 worth of equity. Even worse, if you bought on 5% and now I'm in negative equity. Now, the bank won't sell you up if you're repaying your making your payments, but not a great feeling when you say, gee, I owe more than the place is worth, and I'm paying off $1,400 every month.
Yeah, and that negative equity thing is a real trap, right? Because if you think about the way that you know, you have a 95% mortgage, the equity that you put in goes first. So it's not equally shared between the lender and the borrower. You basically take the first hit, and then of course the idea is then the government takes the next 15% hit, and then the lender takes the hit below that. So effectively, the risks are spread all over the place. But actually, as a borrower, you take the first hit. And of course, you have a 20% mortgage, and that 20% is equity. You could lose that equity. And, you know, we know from the UK, there were significant examples there where people got into negative equity, and then they got stuck there, not just for a few months, but for years. And in some cases, 10 years later, they are still sitting on the negative equity trap. So it's really important people actually stand back and think about not only what happens if my income, you know, evaporates, but also what happens if prices do go down. And look, people don't want to explore that quite often because, of course, prices double every 7 years. Yeah, I believe that. You believe anything. Not true. The fact is that there are situations quite often where prices do fall and are falling, and you can end up with a very significant headache. And, of course, it stops you then moving. It stops you then potentially doing things you'd want to do in terms of developing your own lifestyle. These are really big, important decisions. And I just think sometimes people get swept up in the moment thinking, oh, the government's giving us free money, without standing back and thinking about the consequences.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the very obvious simple consequence is that you have 5% deposit. It means your loan is $75,000 more than it was going to be if you'd actually worked on getting to the full $100,000 and 20% deposit. That's a lot. And in particular, if you go negative equity, your repayments are higher already. You're more likely to find a little bit of strife. You know, it will stress the family budget more. And if you fail, the bank doesn't have much of a buffer anymore. Now, sure, there's LMI and stuff like that, but the buffer has diminished for everybody. So you might find a banker who's a little less patient with you if you're in negative equity or very skinny equity compared to someone who's got 20 or even more percent. So I think pressure could come right onto people for a short-term gain.
Well, that's right. And, you know, just reflecting on that particular point, 95%, basically that means there's a bit of a higher risk. Some of the rates that are being offered are also higher. So you end up not only having a bigger loan and bigger repayments, but you're actually the rate that you can get compared with other people could well be higher too.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the government schemes are classic. There are 20 lenders or something, and generally, they've got reasonable loans that they're not ridiculously high priced loans. They're okay, but they're not at the very lowest end of the market. And you can save, you know, you can get loans much, much cheaper than those currently. So, you know, and you'll be stuck in that loan for quite a while. Whereas maybe if you had 20% deposit, you'd be able to get in at the bottom. And then in 2 years' time, maybe refinance again, because frankly, if you don't refinance or look at it every couple of years, you will be falling behind. There's no question in that. So I think you can lose all round by going too early and put yourself under just so much pressure.
Absolutely. And the other thing you mentioned, lenders mortgage insurance, we should just touch on that briefly, right? Because essentially lenders mortgage insurance is generally offered on loans with 80% and above. In other words, 20% equity or less that you have. Just be clear about what an LMI is. Lender's mortgage insurance insures the lender. It doesn't insure the borrower. You have to pay a premium for that particular insurance. It can sometimes be capitalized into the total loan amount. But nevertheless, it's an additional cost and it can be thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it can be. It can be $12,000 and stuff like that. It's a lot. And the point you're making is absolutely right. People would think, well, I'm taking out an insurance policy. That's got to be good. Well, yes, you're not. The bank is getting you to take out an insurance policy that covers them. It's interesting. Most of the lenders who are actually absorbing it or paying the premium themselves still charge you $1 of the premium. And it's so that you are a party to this insurance over the loan. So it's not just them. They're paying the premium for you, but you're taking out the cover, but it's covering them, not you. So you don't take too much comfort from that. It gets you into the property earlier, but that's all it does for you. It helps the bank. And okay, I mean, the bank's not going to take ridiculous risk without it, but you've had the benefit. Don't think you'll get it twice. And having that insurance, with some cover, you can get a refund if you refinance the loan or sell the property or something, but with a lot of them, you can't. So you're locked into the loan until you really get the equity back down to the point where you've got about 20%.
Yeah, it's not very portable. And the other point to make there is that even if they don't charge you much for the premium, in other words, they absorb it, those costs are actually being in some way spread across the products and services that the bank's providing. So it's not completely free lunch. And I think this whole concept of LMIs enabling more people to get into the market is missing the key point, right? That it's actually protecting the bank. Somebody's got to pay for it. And again, it traps you in. And that's what I'm concerned about. Many people, you know, of all the things we've been talking about, people get trapped and don't really trip over the downside until later. And unfortunately, quite often it's when things go a bit wrong that suddenly light dawns.
Yeah, look, fear of missing out has driven a lot of bad decisions over a long time. And we're seeing it again now. I think there's no question fear of missing out is coming back in. People thought we'd have already seen a fall in the property prices, just they haven't looked at history very well. And they think that there'll be a boom. Now, heck, that's not the way I see it, but who knows, it could happen. There's a lot of stimulus being thrown into this pot. Booms re-stimulated this way sometimes a pretty short run, and sometimes, you know, boom brightly, then fall over and correct a bit.
Absolutely.
I'm still nervous about it, and I'm worried that people driven by fear of missing out are going to make some really dumb decisions.
Yeah, and the final point, just to dwell a little bit on, is when the bank does the assessment of a particular transaction, right, they basically make an assessment of the risk to them. In other words, is the risk to them acceptable or not? That is not the same as whether it's the right thing for you as a borrower to commit to. I would say, and a lot of people assume that if the bank says yes, it'll be fine. I wish it was like that, but it's just not.
No, it's not. And I've always said, look, if you can't make your repayments on the loan, you've got a problem. That's going to really hurt you. If the bank then doesn't have enough, you don't have enough equity, or it's not insured, the loan's not insured, and the bank can't realise enough on the property to clear the loan, then that's their problem. Yeah. That's one of the things, that's one of their key focuses, to make sure that your problem doesn't become their problem. Mm. And they're a business, you know, and that's the way they've got to do it. But on the way through, some people aren't very good at assessing where they're going to have a problem. So you've got to hope that the bank does that. Now, I don't think they're going to take ridiculous risks in this market. But sooner or later, when you get into those very exuberant boom markets, that's when everyone gets too excited sometimes, and bankers start taking risk and buyers start taking risk. And if everyone's in that mode, that's when the mistakes happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're still seeing some loans at 6 and 7 and 8 times income, right, being written even now. That's extreme. That's excessive. You know, normally 3 to 4 times would be a more normal, acceptable range. And my perspective is this, Steve, that people need to make their own cash flows and do their own calculations and their own sensitivities. You know, what if my income goes down, or what if, so that they actually know what they're getting into, rather than just completing the application form and throwing it over the fence and saying, well, if the bank says yes, then it's yes, right? There's more to be done. And the final point, I guess, if they go to places like CanStar, they can actually see the range of different propositions that are available, and it is worth checking around as well.
Yeah, look, I always encourage people to do a couple of things. And one is to, look at all the options that are available and choose one of the lower priced options that has a lot of flexibility so that you can get ahead ultimately. But the other thing is that I say, look, play with the calculators so that you understand that if a rate goes up, that this is how much more it will cost you. And say, well, do I think I can afford that? Because rates will go up. It's just a matter of when, not if. And then do the same with the loan amount. You know, am I stretching too far if I think, well, I will borrow on 5% and owe 475, not 400? What does that mean in terms of repayments? And think, well, can I really comfortably afford this? Because there's a reason for 20% equity. One is to protect the bank, but the other one is to say, well, you know, you're in a position where you've shown that you can save, you can repay, and you're keeping the loan amount to a manageable level. Now, I think I always say to people, look, play with calculators. They're great tools. They're fun to use. They take no time. And you don't even have to educate yourself a lot about the market or finance or anything else. You will intuitively get it. And it's and it can ring little warning bells that say, wait a bit and save a bit more.
Yeah, and just remember, most people in real terms have not seen their incomes rise since 2012. So you should not be factoring into your modelling an assumption of significant wage rises over the next 2 to 5 years. That's something else just to bear in mind.
Yeah, it is. And this is the interest-only crisis that fortunately we've stopped as a community and as a market. But people were taking interest-only loans for owner-occupied when, frankly, they didn't have enough income to repay the loan. And the presumption was that that in 5 years' time, when the interest-only period was over, that they would have had lots and lots of pay increases, and suddenly they'd be able to make principal and interest reductions. And no one got big pay increases. They're getting 1%, 1.5% a year, and that's it. So not enough to actually be able to now afford principal and interest. Now, people have kind of, I think banks have sort of said, well, we'll roll the interest-only period over, but that's just kicking the can down the road, and sooner or later people will have to afford it. And inflation's not taking off fast. So we've got more of the same, I think.
Right, and then add that to the risk that house prices may not grow that much ahead, nothing like we've had over the last 20 or 30 years. So, you know, the other get-out-of-jail card was capital appreciation. Well, that may not be there too. So basically, no income growth, no capital appreciation. That means that this loan is going to be more ugly and bigger down the track than normal, as it were, and people need to think about that as well.
Well, that's right. And you know, think about what's driven the whole efficacy of this market. It's been growing population through migration and through high tourism. We've had 12 months now of none of that, and we're going to have another 12 months of virtually none of that. So we've had 2 years of hiatus where there is no reason for property prices to go up, no reason for rentals to go up, been high vacancy rates in certain places, and frankly, you know, that slows the get out of jail card, as you say, which is inflation and capital growth and property, inflation of incomes, is going to be slow for a while. It's not going to recover for quite a while. So it's the great mistakes that people made in the 80s in business that were all papered over because of inflation, just those escapes aren't there anymore. You've got to make good decisions now, not expect inflation to fix it.
Yeah, well, there's the old adage when you do DIY, measure twice and cut once, right? I think the same should be in when you're thinking as a first-time buyer. But what I would say is do your calculations twice and think about all of these permutations and parameters. Don't jump in and say, oh, she'll be right, because they might not be right. And the decisions you take today can haunt you for a generation if you actually make the wrong decisions.
Oh, yeah, look, and there's the exuberance of it. You see your friends jumping into the market. You see politicians encouraging people to take up all of these incentives. And you think, well, I'm doing this in the national interest as well as my own. And if I don't do it now, I'll miss out and never get in for another generation. All the stimulus is to move now and planning and proving to yourself that you can actually afford it by showing in a savings plan that you can afford it is the best prep. And you don't want to hit that shock the day you buy when it says, oh, I didn't realize I'd have to do without that as well.
Yeah, spot on. Steve, I appreciate your time today. And as always, your wisdom comes through in spades. So thank you very much. And you know, to all our viewers, if you're a first-time buyer, think twice, make sure you do all the homework, and don't back yourself into a corner that down the track you might have difficulty with.
Yeah, cheers, Martin. I couldn't agree more. I think that's right. I'd never discourage people from getting into the housing market. It's what gets people ahead, and it's the dream, and maintain the dream, but make the decision sensibly in the cold light of day.
Absolutely. A dream, not a nightmare. Thanks, Steve. See you next time.
Thanks, Martin. Cheers.
Bye.